$80 million in sales from 1,600 restaurants. By the decade's end, it would collect $6.2 billion from 6,200 stores. More than half of that cash would be handed over through drive-through windows. My dad didn't care how it had all happened. He was just happy it happened at all. In fact, I can say with relative certainty that had he been asked to rank the greatest advancements of the 20th century, my father would have placed the drive-through window somewhere near the polio vaccine, well above personal computers, not quite as high as graphite-shafted golf clubs. Finally, he had a means to put an end to his family's incessant, unreasonable, he might argue, demands to eat more than once a day while on the road. Of course, the explosion of McDonald's restaurants and drive-through windows along the highways only solved the problem of quickly feeding the family. Inevitably, with six people in our car, at least one of us would also have to use the restroom. To complete both tasks with maximum efficiency, my father devised a plan that my family, after regular and rigorous practice, eventually executed to perfection. The goal was simple: keep the car's wheels moving forward at all times. Prior to getting into the drive-through line, my father would take everyone's food orders and pull up along the side entrance to the restaurant. Any prospective peers would be quickly discharged onto the curb. As the youngest, I never really had any choice about getting out of the car. I was simply pushed out as my brothers bolted through the door. In keeping with his goal, my father never stopped to let us out. He'd simply slow down enough to allow us to leap and still have a chance of landing on our feet. Once inside the restaurant, we'd sprint to the restrooms while Dad eased the car ahead to place our order. At the time, McDonald's goal was to provide each drive-through customer's order within 50 seconds. Factoring in a few additional moments for my father to pause, not stop, while drivers ahead of him ordered, we had about 90 seconds to pee, wash up, and dash out the door to intercept our passing car. Usually, we ran the drill to perfection. When we were all on our game, we could go from hungry family on the highway to happy family on the on-ramp in 7, maybe even 6 minutes. Dad actually timed our performance. There were occasional hiccups, often due to circumstances beyond our control. There might be a line at the urinal. One of us might have to go number 2. There could be a backup at the pickup window. Any of these delays could add seconds, even minutes, to the process, causing my dad's blood pressure to redline. But nothing made the curvy vein in my father's right temple squirm more than when he was told to pull forward and park because there'd be a short wait to prepare the plain quarter pounder ordered by my brother Bruce. McDonald's simply wasn't set up to accommodate special orders. The chain's assembly line-style, speedy service system, which had revolutionized the fast food industry since its introduction in 1948, was designed to prepare food exactly one way, the McDonald's way. It was quick, efficient, and notoriously inflexible. When a customer requested a burger prepared any way other than the McDonald's way, say plain with no ketchup, mustard, onions, or pickles, the system broke down. As did my father whenever we sat waiting for my brother's plain hamburger. Of course, McDonald's inability to handle special orders like Bruce's plain hamburger was also noticed by the chain's rival, Burger King. It became the basis for Burger King's long-running Have It Your Way ad campaign, launched in 1973. If you lived through the period, the following jingle will now be lodged in your brain. Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce. Special orders don't upset us. No doubt you remember the rest. To my dad's credit, he didn't blame Bruce for wanting a plain hamburger. Heck, the way he saw it, his kid was ordering a burger that required less labor and fewer ingredients. It should have been ready in half the time for a fraction of the price. Instead, all he got was an agonizing delay in getting back on the highway. It wasn't a good way to make time. Still, my dad and therefore my entire family remained steadfastly loyal to McDonald's throughout our travels. On many occasions, even when we were famished while on the road, we'd bypass exits with clearly visible signs for Burger King, Arby's, or other chains in hopes of finding a McDonald's somewhere farther down the highway. This wasn't the sure thing in the 70s that it is today. In 1978, there were fewer than 4,000 McDonald's scattered across the United States, compared to more than 14,000 in 2016. It was even less likely to encounter a McDonald's along highways out in the boonies, where we always seem to find ourselves around mealtime. There were many reasons for my father's unwavering devotion to McDonald's. And it wasn't just drive-through windows. For starters, my dad felt a certain kinship with Ray Kroc, the man who turned McDonald's into an international phenomenon. Though my father was born 2 decades after Kroc in 1926, both men grew up in the modest suburbs of Chicago, a city where hometown loyalty runs deep. Like my father, Kroc was a salesman who didn't find real success until later in life, after turning 50 years old. Whereas my dad sold electronic fixtures and lighting systems for a living for the first half of his life, Kroc sold restaurant equipment. In 1954, Kroc's interest was piqued when a small restaurant located on the edge of the desert in San Bernardino, California, ordered 8 of the expensive high-end multi-mixer blenders he sold, enough to make 40 milkshakes at a time. The restaurant was a simple burger stand owned by 2 brothers, Dick and Maurice "Mac" McDonald. Curious as to why such a modest operation could possibly need such equipment, Kroc decided to fly out and pay the McDonald brothers a visit. What he saw astounded him. A 600-square-foot restaurant, little more than a walk-up stand, with customers lined up by the dozen to order from a simple menu of hamburgers, fries, sodas, and shakes, being efficiently churned out in assembly line fashion by a handful of hard-working staff. The prices were cheap, and the food was tasty and easy to eat on the go. Recognizing the formula's enormous potential, Kroc convinced the McDonald brothers to sell him the McDonald's name and national franchising rights. He then returned to Illinois to begin building an empire. Headquartered near Chicago, McDonald's initially launched franchises across northern Illinois and the Midwest, in locations my dad frequently visited on sales calls. Throughout the 1960s, McDonald's opened restaurants as fast as its cooks could flip burgers. By the 70s, no fast food chain came close to matching the dominant presence of McDonald's in Middle America. It therefore only made sense that we found ourselves going to McDonald's more than to any other chain. There were simply far more McDonald's to be found. Along the highways we traveled into and out of the Midwest, McDonald's was truly the Big Mac. Aside from all else, my family genuinely enjoyed McDonald's food. It wasn't fancy, but it was satisfying and predictable. A McMuffin in Milwaukee tasted the same as the one in Memphis. A Big Mac in Burlington was as big as the one in Baton Rouge. Such consistency was an enormous draw for families like mine while out exploring America. It was a familiar taste of home in places that seemed a world away. Ray Kroc knew the importance of such uniformity, and his obsessive approach to maintaining it became legendary. It was Kroc himself who dictated the strict specifications for a McDonald's hamburger. The beef patty had to be exactly 3.875 inches in diameter and 1.6 ounces in weight, and contain precisely 19% fat. Big Mac buns should have on average 178 sesame seeds. He even decreed how much wax should be used on the wax paper in which McDonald's hamburgers were wrapped. No detail was too small. Most important, eating at McDonald's fit our modest travel budget. After all, the restaurant was cheap, and, well, so was my dad, at least when it came to discretionary expenditures such as food. Yet even as inexpensive as McDonald's was, Dad found ways to trim the tab further. Before being dropped off to make our drive-through potty runs, my siblings and I would take turns rattling off our food orders. As we did, Dad would mentally combine and edit our orders for maximum value before pulling up to the speaker. If 3 of us wanted our own regular size Coke, he'd instead order 1 large Coke costing half the price and ask for 3 complimentary kitty cups. Indeed, long before McDonald's introduced the supersize concept, my father came up with shrink-a-size, If Dad believed one of us had placed an order that exceeded our appetite, he'd simply scale it back. Hence, many an optimistically ordered Big Mac became a less than enthusiastically received regular hamburger. We discovered these arbitrary changes too late. This was because Dad would collect our food from the pickup window while we were still rushing to relieve ourselves. As we dove back into our seats, he'd casually say, "Hey, let's not make a mess. Why don't we wait until we're back on the highway and not making so many turns before we hand out the food?" Then he'd place the bags of food on the floor at his feet until he navigated back to the on-ramp. It was only after we were at cruising speed and far past any turnarounds that he'd begin distributing the disappointment. Making matters worse, before Dad handed back the single order of fries he'd ordered for my brothers and me to split, he first shoveled a half dozen or so of the biggest ones into his mouth. It was a subtraction we came to expect and derisively call the Dad Tax. As we grew older and smarter, we'd attempt various strategies to defeat my father's penny pinching. For example, ordering two Big Macs each in hopes of getting just the one we wanted. But these tactics rarely worked. When it came to deciding what and how much food we'd get in a trip to the drive-thru, my dad was, in the most literal sense of the phrase, always in the driver's seat. It wouldn't be until I had my own driver's license that I received exactly what I ordered at a McDonald's drive-thru. Chapter 8, In and Out. Motels, Hotels, and Invaders from Space. If the idea of briefly exiting the highway to eat or use the restroom irritated my father, the thought of stopping for hours, mind you, just to spend the night sleeping in a roadside motel seemed borderline insane. As my father saw it, 10 hours at a motel was 10 hours less at our final destination. Why, a man could play 2 rounds of golf in that kind of time. Of course, Dad had considered driving straight through to our destination. He even attempted it on one of our early trips, a marathon 19-hour expedition to the Florida Gulf Coast. The trip seemed to go well as far as we kids were concerned. We traveled all day and through the night, leaving behind the blustery Wisconsin winter to awaken the following morning basking in the golden warmth of a Florida sunrise. Sure, we were tired and restless from spending an entire night crammed into our car, shifting about to find tolerable sleeping positions, but we'd made it to our destination safe and sound, and gained an extra day of beach time in the bargain. So it always seemed strange that we never attempted to drive straight through again. It was only years later that my mom let us in on what happened as we all slept that dark early morning. Awakened by a loud rumbling under her seat, she initially thought we'd blown a hole in our exhaust. But she quickly realized our car was veering off the highway onto the gravel shoulder. Glancing over at my dad, she saw his eyes were closed and that his head was bobbing, as though he were taking in a Sunday sermon. His pious posture was appropriate, as we were all just a moment from meeting our maker. Acting quickly, Mom grabbed the steering wheel with one hand and prodded Dad with the other, alerting him that the cruise control was hurtling us at a speed of 64 miles per hour to certain doom. Fortunately, the car remained on the highway. The whole incident was over in a heartbeat, or in my mom's case, a few hundred heartbeats, and my siblings and I remained asleep the entire time. But Dad had received his wake-up call. He knew how close he'd come to driving us all to our final destination. The idea of ever again attempting to drive through the night had been put to rest. That being the case, once or twice each way per road trip, depending on the distance to our destination and my parents' tolerance for spending hours in a 5-passenger car packed with 6 people, my dad reluctantly pulled up to a motel to spend the night. Nearly always, we'd stick to one of the major lodging chains, for a couple of reasons. First, in the same way that McDonald's offered a uniform eating experience, the big hotel chains offered a uniform lodging experience. With the brand names, we knew what to expect. A clean, comfortable room with a few basic amenities at an affordable rate. Second, in an era long before the internet and Google, The chains were able to provide printed lists of franchise locations with phone numbers along our route. These lists came in especially handy because my dad never wanted to be constrained by room reservations. If the open road beckoned him to drive a bit farther, he wanted to do just that. The more cities and towns he could put in our rearview mirror, the better. The way it worked was that each day around dinner time, when we'd pull off the highway to grab a bite or fuel up, Dad would pull out the triptych and motel guides. Then he'd begin popping dimes into a payphone to try to secure our evening's accommodations, as the rest of us surreptitiously listened. My father always began these conversations with the same question. "So how's your availability tonight for a tired family a long way from home?" This wasn't just my dad's way of breaking the ice. It was negotiating 101, determining supply and demand. If the motel clerk responded that she had plenty of rooms and would have no problem accommodating us, Dad would break out his standard follow-up. "Well, what's your special rate for a nice Midwestern family traveling on a tight budget?" This was where the bargaining began. Dad's tactic was to launch into a torturous tale of woe, hoping to appeal to the employee's charitable nature. His sob story would include references to every minor setback we'd faced on our journey. Frequently, there was a dissertation on the burden of high gas prices on middle-class families, and musings on the uncertainties faced by lodging operators in a flagging economy. No one could plead poverty like my father. He was usually successful in securing some discount, often because the person on the other end just wanted to get my dad off the phone. As soon as we heard Dad launch into this soliloquy, we'd all breathe a sigh of relief. We knew the motel had a vacancy, and we could probably look forward to a swim in the pool before bedtime. But things didn't always go well. Sometimes my dad's second inquiry concerned other lodging in the area, perhaps an exit or two down the road. Often this query would occur in the worst of circumstances, when it was pouring rain and more prudent travelers had already snatched up the available rooms, or when we were in an area where there weren't other motels for miles around. When we'd hear Dad ask about other options, we'd all take a nervous gulp. We knew our chances of having to drive late into the night or spend the evening at the Bedbug Inn or some similarly named establishment, the kind where we'd find mouse traps under the beds, had just increased exponentially. Most often, we ended up at either a Holiday Inn or a Ramada Inn. Though fierce competitors, the two chains had much in common. In fact, the men who were the driving forces behind them had strikingly, almost eerily, similar backgrounds. Holiday Inn was founded by Charles Kemmons Wilson in 1952. 2 years later, Marion W. Isbell welcomed guests into the first of his properties that would form the Ramada Inn chain. Born just 4 years apart, Wilson first in 1901, both men grew up in dire straits after losing parents at a young age. Wilson's father passed away when he was just 9 months old, forcing his mother to move to Memphis, Tennessee, where she had family who could assist with caring for Charles, who would eventually go by Kemmons, while she worked as a dental assistant. Isbell lost both of his parents before he turned 5 years old. He and his brothers were claimed by relatives and raised in the first of a string of parallels with Wilson, also in Memphis. Against all odds, both men rose above their challenging circumstances to build modest fortunes through thrift and hard work. Wilson's entrepreneurial inclinations first surfaced at age 6, when he began selling subscriptions to the Saturday Evening Post door to door. To make more money, he recruited classmates as his sales staff. When Wilson's mother lost her job during the Depression, he dropped out of high school to bag groceries and deliver newspapers so the pair had money to eat. Upon turning 17, he took a chance to improve their lot by borrowing $50 from a friend to purchase a machine to make popcorn that he sold in a local movie theater. Within 3 years, Wilson scraped together $1,300 to build a home, literally with his own hands. Wilson then mortgaged the property to purchase a Wurlitzer jukebox franchise, parlaying the profits into ownership of several movie theaters. After serving in World War II, Wilson realized that millions of his fellow GIs would be looking to start families and purchase houses. Drawing on what he'd learned building his own home, Wilson started a construction business, eventually partnering with the most successful home builder in the South. By 1950, Wilson was a millionaire. Like Wilson, Marion Isbell also began working at an exceptionally young age. Isbell was just 8 years old when he entered the fields outside Memphis to pick cotton every day after school. For his efforts, he earned around 5 cents per day, more or less depending on the weight of the cotton he collected. In another parallel with his eventual rival, Isbell was forced to drop out of school to help support his family. He withdrew from his studies at age 12 to take a job running errands for a local chemical company. By the time he turned 16, he was ready to see what the world beyond Memphis had to offer. Along with his brother James, Isbell packed up his meager belongings and moved to Chicago. There, the two boys found employment washing dishes, cooking meals, and jerking at soda counters. As they socked away their meager earnings, they also learned every facet of running a restaurant. In 1934, the Isbell brothers opened their own luncheonette. Within a decade, they owned an entire chain. Decades of hard work had taken Wilson and Isbell a long way. But both would find the inspiration for their most successful endeavors by taking a little time off. The idea would occur to Marion Isbell first, though it would be 2 decades before he could act on it. In 1929, Isbell and his wife, Ingrid, decided to join the legions of motorists setting out to discover America. Touring the country with their 3 children, the Isbells were fascinated by the scenery and landmarks they saw each day. But the accommodations that awaited them each evening, dingy, often outright dirty motor courts lacking the most basic amenities, left them appalled. Worse, the rundown properties attracted seedy characters engaging in sordid activities. Clearly, these weren't places for respectable young families. Isbell envisioned opening a chain of lodging properties that combined the amenities of pricey downtown hotels with the convenient locations and reasonable rates of roadside motels. But Isbell was just 25 years old and already struggling to support a young family. His idea would have to wait. Inspiration would similarly strike Kemmons Wilson while on vacation with his family. But Wilson didn't embark on his fateful trip until 1951, when he was already a wealthy and successful businessman. It was then that Wilson and his wife Dorothy decided to take their 5 kids to visit the nation's capital. It says much about Wilson that although he could easily afford to do so, he didn't purchase plane tickets for his family. Instead, he piled his 7-member clan into the family Oldsmobile, a vehicle without air conditioning, and set out from Memphis in the sweltering August heat. It says more about Wilson that along the journey, he refused to pay the expensive rates charged by city hotels, opting instead to stay in mom-and-pop boarding houses and tourist courts. I have little doubt that Wilson and my father would have gotten along well. The accommodations Wilson found in 1951 differed little from those Isbell and his family encountered in 1929. Amenities and cleanliness varied wildly from one operation to the next. Worse, Wilson discovered, proprietors nickel and dimed him for every little extra, from ice cubes and baby cribs to, in one case, clean sheets. But what really got his goat was that he was charged an additional fee for each child in his family. At one motor court, charging $6 a night, he was slapped with an additional $2 fee for each of his 5 kids, more than doubling his bill. Fuming, he declared to Dorothy that he was going to start his own hotel chain, one traveling families could depend on for clean, affordable accommodations with no surprises or additional charges. Dorothy laughed and asked how many hotels he planned to open. Wilson considered the question a moment and declared that 400 would be a good start. Though Wilson's anger passed, the idea didn't. The more he thought about it, the more he became convinced that with so many middle-class families taking to the road, there really was a market for an affordably priced motel chain. he decided that the motels should make standard a variety of family-focused amenities. Rooms with television sets, devices just being introduced at the time, air conditioning, a nod to Wilson's experience traveling in his stifling Oldsmobile, ice machines in every hallway, dog kennels, complimentary baby cribs, in-room phones, swimming pools, free parking, and even a list of nearby babysitters. Oh, and one more item. A Bible in every room. Perhaps he figured parents would be looking for divine guidance after a long day on the road with the kids. In 1952, Wilson's vision became a reality. The first of his motels opened on Summer Avenue in Memphis, just off a two-lane highway. The property was bathed in bright cherry green and yellow colors selected by Wilson's mother. However, Wilson designed the property's roadside sign himself. Recalling his days working in movie houses, Wilson conceived a sign that resembled a theater marquee. The monstrous structure blazed with the light of 1,500 feet of neon tubing and 500 incandescent bulbs. From the base arose a large yellow arrow that curved around the sign's top, pointing the way to the check-in desk. Tucked beneath the motel's name was a glowing marquee on which employees could arrange black letters to welcome happy honeymooners and local civic groups. And atop it all shimmered a blinking neon star to serve as a beacon for weary travelers. In time, the garish Goliath would come to be called the Great Sign. After Wilson retired in 1979, the Great Sign soon followed. In 1982, the Holiday Inn Board of Directors voted to phase out the expensive sign and replace it with a cheaper, more contemporary-looking design. Furious, Wilson called the decision the worst mistake they ever made. To punctuate his statement, he even specified that the design of his beloved sign be engraved on his tombstone, an order dutifully carried out upon his passing in 2003. It would become one of the true icons of American travel. The name on the sign? That would be lifted from a 1942 movie musical starring Bing Crosby. Wilson's architect, Eddie Bluestein, had seen the film the evening before completing his final sketch of the motel and scrawled the title above his drawing as a good-natured joke. On seeing it, Wilson thought the title perfectly captured his vision of a wholesome home away from home for vacationing families. The name, of course, was Holiday Inn. Holiday Inn's combination of clean accommodations, family-friendly amenities, and low rates, $6 a night with no hidden extras, was an instant success. What's more, Wilson's timing couldn't have been better. America's interstate highway system was just years from approval. When the interstate project was given the green light, Wilson followed an expansion strategy similar to Bill Stuckey's. He constructed new Holiday Inns along each highway at a distance of a full day's drive from one location to the next. As a convenience for travelers and a way to lock in business, Wilson instructed his managers to ask guests if they could assist in making reservations for the following evening as well. Of course, all the managers had to do was place a call to the next Holiday Inn located along their guests' planned route. Because every Holiday Inn was nearly identical in construction, rates, and amenities, travelers had no reason to decline the helpful offer or consider alternatives. Wilson's strategy worked like a charm. In 1959, Holiday Inn had 100 locations. By 1975, there were an astounding 1,700. Wilson himself would appear on the cover of Time magazine in 1972, hailed as the man with 300,000 beds. Marion Isbell and his Ramada Inns would never rise to the dizzying heights of Kemmons Wilson and Holiday Inn. But Isbell did found the company that would, at least for the period of my family's peak travel years in the 1970s, become the second largest hotel chain in America. Isbell and Ramada would also win the loyalty of a very select but important clientele, my parents. The idea of a nationwide chain of family-friendly motor hotels dawned on Isbell before Wilson had the idea. But he didn't have Wilson's means or vision to build such an operation from scratch. What Isbell did have were affluent business connections from his years in Chicago. And in the early 1950s, after selling his interest in the chain of restaurants he co-owned with his brother, Isbell found himself with money and time on his hands. As America headed toward building an interstate highway system, Isbell recalled the idea that occurred to him on his trip decades earlier and realized the time had come to act. So in 1954, 2 years after Wilson opened the original Holiday Inn in Memphis, Isbell and a group of investors began buying and building motels, primarily in Arizona along Route 66. By 1960, Isbell's group owned dozens of properties, which he unified into a chain. The name Ramada was chosen to honor the company's southwestern roots. During harvest time in the region, laborers in the fields would assemble temporary shelters from ramas, Spanish for branches, to provide shade for their afternoon siestas. They called the structures ramadas. Isbell thought the name was perfect for his collection of comfy roadside inns. Given the chain's name, one would also expect a southwestern theme for each inn's decor. Colorful stucco, perhaps, and a terracotta roof. But that wasn't the case. Instead, the Ramada Inns were initially built to resemble grand estates straight out of colonial Williamsburg. Each building was a sprawling two-story pile of red brick, with long rows of windows flanked by white wooden shutters. In the center, an imposing porte cochere jutted out over the main entrance, supported by stately pillars. And on the sign out front, waiting to welcome guests, was Uncle Ben, an affable-looking balding chap in a colonial-style knee-length jacket and buckled shoes, holding a top hat in one hand and an implausibly elongated trumpet in the other, from which dangled the regal red Ramada Inn banner. Isbell chose the colonial theme as a dignified alternative to the colorful, lowbrow tackiness of Holiday Inn or Howard Johnson's. But really, it was just cheese of a different flavor. My parents loved Ramada Inns. To them, Ramada was the classiest of the major chains. My folks were particularly smitten with Ramada's lobbies, which the company obviously emphasized. Most Ramada Inn lobbies were 2 stories tall, providing space for an almost comically oversized crystal chandelier. Guests were encouraged to admire its twinkling splendor from all angles, by climbing a grand staircase up to a banistered overlook. The windows were covered from floor to ceiling in tassel-trimmed draperies that appeared to be plundered from Scarlett O'Hara's Tara. An equally Baroque fabric was selected to upholster the Victorian-style high-backed chairs and dust-ruffled couches placed here and there throughout the room. The furniture was assembled in tiny islands on a sea of carpeting dyed a retina-burning shade of royal red, the chain's signature color. Ramada intended its lobby to exude elegance. It looked more like the dining room at Elvis Presley's Graceland. Still, my parents adored it. So while most of America was checking into a Holiday Inn, my family spent the early 1970s bedding down with Uncle Ben, in a manner of speaking. In keeping with Ramada's colonial theme, we were patriotically loyal to the chain. As we did for McDonald's, we'd often go the extra mile, or 20, driving into the night just to reach one of those foofy foyers. In reality, once you got past the lobby, very little distinguished the two chains. Both charged about the same rate for a same-size room and offered about the same amenities. Aside from the sign out front and the lobby decor, Holiday Inns and Ramada Inns were virtually indistinguishable. That is, until a point in the middle of the decade, no one can seem to recall precisely the date or location, when Holiday Inn began introducing the Holodome. By the 1970s, the concept of a domed motel offering guests a climate-controlled common area in which to gather and relax had probably become inevitable. It was, after all, an era when America became enthralled with the notion of bringing the great outdoors indoors. Suddenly, sports and leisure activities traditionally enjoyed outside were no longer left to the capricious whims of nature, not when they could be brought inside, protected from the elements, synthetically recreated, and artificially regulated for maximum comfort. The dome craze can be traced back to 1965, when the city of Houston unveiled the Astrodome, hailed at the time as the 8th wonder of the world. But the 70s was the true decade of the dome, with domes bubbling up just about everywhere. Following Houston's lead, one city after another cut the ribbon on its own gleaming domed megastadium. Detroit unveiled the Silver Dome in 1975, followed by Seattle's King Dome, and New Orleans' Superdome in 1976. Minneapolis broke ground on its Metrodome in 1979, though it wasn't open to host events until 3 years later. More domed venues sprang up to host collegiate sports events at the University of Northern Iowa, UNI Dome, Idaho State University, Holt Arena, Syracuse University, Carrier Dome, the University of South Dakota, Dakota Dome, and Northern Arizona University, Walk-Up Sky Dome, to list just a few. On a smaller scale, municipalities and private clubs in northern climates erected giant inflatable domes to house driving ranges, playing fields, and setup areas for wintertime diversions. Even Disney caught dome fever. In 1975, Walt Disney World opened the world's first indoor roller coaster inside a domed structure it dubbed Space Mountain. In the 70s, domes, well, dominated. Holiday Inn's Holodome concept did more than play into some trendy dome craze, however. It solved a number of worrisome problems for the chain. The first of these was the decline that naturally comes with aging. By the mid-1970s, many Holiday Inns were 20 years old, and showing every wrinkle. Even Kemmons Wilson's original Holiday Inn in Memphis had fallen into disrepair, and closed in 1973. Despite its historic significance, Wilson's original Holiday Inn, the one that launched the world's leading hotel chain, sat vacant and deteriorating for years. The building finally fell to a wrecking ball in the early 1990s. Sure, franchisees could have spruced up their properties with a fresh coat of paint and new curtains. Many did. But by erecting a large plexiglass dome over and around the central courtyard, their motel became something else entirely. Suddenly, a fading Holiday Inn was transformed into a sleek and futuristic, climate-controlled oasis straight out of Logan's Run or Battlestar Galactica, a pair of 70s pop culture sensations that showcase the virtues of skin-tight bodysuits. Another issue the Holodome solved related to a flaw in the original Holiday Inn layout. When first launched, every Holiday Inn offered rooms with doors opening to the outside. But by the 70s, this arrangement, once considered an asset, had become a liability. Whereas traveling families once appreciated the convenience of being able to drive right up to their room's door, now many found that the setup presented a number of drawbacks. Noise and exhaust from the parking lot drifted through the door and into the room. Also, because guests weren't required to pass the front desk, the layout attracted customers seeking private spaces in which to conduct illicit activities and improper, ahem, affairs. It was a situation entirely at odds with Holiday Inn's family-friendly image. By enclosing the properties, franchisees were able to switch their rooms' doors to the opposite side, so they opened into a hallway or the domed courtyard. Guests needed to walk past the front desk or through a handful of other entrances to get to their rooms, deterring those who didn't want to be seen coming and going. The Holodome also helped Holiday Inn franchisees distinguish their properties from nearby competitors, especially in colder regions of the country. From his own travels, Kemmons Wilson learned how important swimming pools were to the family lodging experience, and how they played a pivotal role in where families chose to stay. It's the reason that Wilson insisted from the very beginning on making a swimming pool a standard feature of every Holiday Inn. His instincts were dead on. Lodging research conducted during the 1960s showed that adding a pool increased business as much as 60%. That meant a pool paid for its construction in just a few years. But for many Holiday Inn franchisees, the competitive advantage of having a pool disappeared when they were forced to close the facilities during the winter. In much of the country, that was half the year. By adding a Holodome, franchisees were able to promote their pools year-round, and having an edge was turning out to be critical. While my family was an exception, Americans as a whole pulled way back on discretionary travel during the 70s. By the time Jimmy Carter assumed the presidency in 1977, the country's economy showed signs of recovery. But the optimism wouldn't last. Midway through Carter's term, the combination of high unemployment and high inflation prompted the creation of a whole new economic indicator, the misery index. At the same time Americans were losing their jobs, inflation was robbing them of their savings. Much as folks needed to get away from their troubles, many couldn't afford to. But while many Americans decided an extended stay at some distant, high-priced resort no longer fit their budgets, they found a shorter stay at a closer, more modest attraction still did. Holodomes fit the bill perfectly. With a large pool and recreational activities for the kids, an inviting lounge area for adults, and a tropical courtyard with warm temperatures for all, Holodomes offered families a reasonable facsimile of a Florida vacation at a fraction of the cost. While many unimproved Holiday Inns struggled to survive the 70s, those with Holodomes largely thrived. The Holodome captured the spirit of the 70s like nothing else. Everything about it was artificial, tacky, excessive, cheap, haphazardly laid out, and questionably constructed. And really, that was its charm. The exotic trees and tropical plants were all fake. The oversized tiki figures and towering volcano waterslide were fiberglass. The sky over your head was plexiglass, and the grass beneath your feet plastic. The water was highly chlorinated, the temperature overregulated, and the edifice as a whole tastelessly decorated. It was, in short, a majestic synthetic marvel. And it was wonderful. The only thing inside a Holodome that was genuine was the fun. And thanks to its transparent plexiglass ceiling, a Holodome offered just about every amusement under the sun. The main attraction, of course, was the enormous swimming pool, often shaped to resemble a tropical lagoon. Sometimes there would be narrow channels to swim through, with walking bridges to swim under, or even a waterfall at one end. I used to swim the length of the pool pretending I was navigating a crocodile-infested river like the fantastically bronzed Ron Ely in the 1960s TV revamp of Tarzan, which, thanks to reruns, remained in heavy rotation throughout the 70s. In my opinion, Ron Ely remains the best Tarzan to ever play the role. He didn't just don the loincloth, he inhabited the character, performing many of his own stunts to add realism. Ely said that he suffered 24 major injuries while filming the series, including 2 broken shoulders and even several lion bites. He also sported, without question, the most impressive tan in television history prior to the debut of Baywatch. But a Holodome offered far more than a pool. Though the offerings varied by location, the typical setup might also include table tennis, air hockey tables, a shuffleboard deck, a miniature golf course, and clusters of stand-up or tabletop coin-operated video games. For adults, there was nearly always a lounge within eyeshot of the pool's shallow end. This arrangement allowed parents to down their gin and tonics and rum daiquiris, while occasionally casting glances at little Jimmy or Jenny to make sure they were still bobbing above the surface. One aspect that never varied from one Holodome to the next was the damp, heavy air inside. The thermostat was always set to sauna-like levels, and the air was so thick with moisture you were never quite certain when you had actually entered or exited the pool. But it was a small price to pay for being treated to a taste of Florida in June, when you were actually somewhere in Illinois in December. While Kemmons Wilson envisioned his original Holiday Inns as a home away from home, Holodomes offered a kind of vacation within a vacation for guests en route somewhere else. If our route led us in the vicinity of one of those tantalizing terrariums, we rarely passed it by. It really was a holiday in a holodome. As my parents handled check-in at either the Holiday Inn or Ramada front desk, my siblings and I typically would do a checkout, a quick survey of what our motel had to offer. Because we were expected to help unload the car and haul our own bags up to the room, we had to act swiftly. So like any good reconnaissance team, we'd split up. If we hadn't eaten prior to arriving at the motel, and we often hadn't, Leslie would determine if there was an on-site restaurant and head off to scan the menu so she could report back to Mom. Mark would locate the pool and dip a hand in to check the water temperature. Bruce, who was inspired to start working on his physique after seeing Pumping Iron, the 1977 bodybuilding documentary that made Arnold Schwarzenegger an international sensation, went off in search of the fitness area. And I would embark on the most important quest of all, at least as far as I was concerned. I sought out the motel's video game arcade to check out which electronic marvels would soon be vying for my quarters. It would be almost impossible to overstate the importance of video games to an elementary school kid in the 70s. Before my friends and I began noticing the merits of the opposite sex, video games occupied our every waking thought. Video games and my generation were coming of age at the same time. And like best friends growing up next door to each other, we made an inseparable pair. It was a relationship few outside our peer group understood. Parents didn't get it. Even my brothers, just 7 and 8 years older than I, didn't get it. And really, that's what made the connection we shared with video games all the more special. Video games weren't invented in the 70s. Their roots wound back to logic puzzles and data manipulations employed in computer research of the 1940s and 1950s. Those games were created more to test the capabilities of computers than the people who played them. What's more, the only computers on which they could be played were fantastically large and expensive. The first computer designed for commercial sale, UNIVAC 1, short for Universal Automatic Computer, produced by the Remington Rand Typewriter Company in 1951, required a space the size of a 25-meter swimming pool. The computer's control panel alone was the size of a church organ. In 1952, the UNIVAC 1 gained national fame by successfully predicting the outcome of the U.S. presidential election on live television. While most human pollsters forecast a win for Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson, UNIVAC 1 projected an easy victory for popular World War II hero Dwight D. Eisenhower. Believing there must have been some sort of error in UNIVAC's calculations, CBS TV news boss Sig Mikkelsen insisted that UNIVAC's prediction of 100-1 odds in favor of an Eisenhower victory be amended to 8-7. When Eisenhower won by a yawning margin within 1% of UNIVAC's original projection, the network was forced to admit its change. It wasn't until the 1970s and the invention of solid-state integrated circuits that computers became inexpensive or small enough to make video games plausible for a mass audience. The men with the vision and know-how to lead the way were two electrical engineers, Nolan Bushnell and Ted Dabney. Bushnell supplied the vision, Dabney the know-how. Blonde-haired, keen-eyed, and quick-witted, Nolan Bushnell grew up in a Mormon household in Ogden, Utah. At the same time he was studying engineering at the University of Utah, he worked at the nearby Lagoon Amusement Park, where he was assigned to the Midway Arcade. Besides maintaining the arcade's coin-operated pinball machines, he occasionally assumed the role of barker, persuading park guests to try their luck at skee-ball, ring the bottle, and other carnival-type games. Day after day, Bushnell would watch players hand over dollar after dollar to hone their skills at a particular game, conquer the challenge, and win a prize. Back at the computer science labs on campus, Bushnell watched fellow students take breaks from their schoolwork to compete against each other in a game on the lab's mainframe computer. Developed by students at MIT years earlier, the game was called Space War. Two players, each controlling their own spaceship, were pitted against each other in a laser duel. The object was simple. The graphics were primitive, little more than white lines and dots on a black screen. And, as Bushnell learned firsthand, the game was incredibly addictive. When Bushnell graduated, he took his experiences with him to a job in Silicon Valley where he met Ted Dabney, an older, more experienced engineer. Bushnell shared with Dabney his idea for turning the space war concept into a commercial endeavor. Excited by the idea, Dabney collaborated with Bushnell to create a near clone of Space War, called Computer Space. The game flopped. Undaunted, Dabney and Bushnell quit their jobs and formed their own company, setting up shop in the quaintly named town of Sunnyvale. For inspiration as to what to name their startup, Bushnell looked to his favorite board game, a traditional Chinese game similar to chess. Among its many unique Mandarin terms was a word that loosely translated as checkmate. That word was Atari. After forming Atari, Bushnell and Dabney hired another talented engineer, Alan Alcorn, as a junior associate. As a sort of training exercise, Bushnell tasked Alcorn with designing a game similar to one recently debuted by another game designer. It was an electronic version of tennis included with the Magnavox Odyssey, the first video game console for home use. Alcorn aced the exercise. Like Magnavox Odyssey's tennis, Alcorn's game was a simple two-dimensional recreation of a racket sport. Two players competed against each other, using blocky pixelated paddles to bat a white dot representing a ball back and forth from opposite sides of a court. To ratchet up the difficulty and ensure each volley would eventually end, Alcorn added several twists. He invisibly divided the paddle into 8 segments, each returning the ball at a different angle. He made the ball speed up with each successive return. And he added sound effects, including a crowd that booed and cheered along with the players' performances. Bushnell and Dabney were blown away. But wary of their previous failure, they wanted to see how the game would be received in a real-world setting. The game also needed a name. In keeping with their new company's philosophy of keeping things simple, the three men settled on a descriptive 4-letter appellation written in all caps. Pong. To test market the game, Bushnell and Nolan set it up at a local tavern. Days later, Bushnell received a call from the bar's owner. The machine wasn't working. Crestfallen, Bushnell and Alcorn showed up the next morning and found a small group of patrons outside the establishment waiting for the door to be unlocked. As the bar's owner led Bushnell and Alcorn inside, they inquired if customers were really that desperate for a drink so early in the day. Much to their surprise, the man informed them that those waiting were regular patrons who knew repairmen were coming that morning to fix the game, and they wanted to stake their place in line. Bushnell and Alcorn looked at each other in disbelief. Unlocking the game's front panel, Alcorn instantly determined the problem. Though the coin box was filled, players had continued thrusting quarters into the slots, causing a short circuit. Pong was a sensation. Atari released Pong in 1972. From the outset, the company struggled to keep up with demand. Despite initial assembly challenges, Atari sold 2,500 games its first year. In 1974, the company sold 8,000 units and was shipping them overseas. Beyond bars, Pong machines began appearing in restaurants, bowling alleys, convenience stores, and other outlets. The reason was simple. Owners of the machines made money at an astonishing rate, one quarter at a time. Bushnell estimated that each Pong game earned an average of $40 per day, four times the daily revenue of pinball and other coin-operated machines. Atari hadn't just introduced the first widely popular coin-operated video game. It had launched a new industry. Meanwhile, a Japanese engineer employed by Taito was already at work creating the game that would take the craze to a whole new level. His name was Tomohiro Nishikado. He would take his inspiration from H.G. Wells' sci-fi masterpiece, The War of the Worlds. The idea of battling aliens from outer space solved two problems for Nishikado. First, it allowed him to create a shooting game without making humans the targets, avoiding a sensitive issue in post-war Japan. Second, a space environment provided a logical reason for the game's austere appearance. The technology of the time did not yet permit the use of color in video game design. But for an outer space backdrop, color wasn't needed. To incorporate at least some element of color in the design, the North American version of the game included strips of orange and green cellophane physically adhered to the game screen. That way, any white pixel objects on the screen beneath the cellophane appeared to have a tint. To create a space setting, Nishikado needed only sprinkle tiny white stars on a field of black. The game's concept was simple. The player's role was to defend his home planet against armies of invading aliens using a mobile laser cannon, The attacking aliens were aligned in columns and stacked in layers. After clearing an entire screen of marauders, the player would advance to a more challenging stage. Nishikado believed this progression would inspire the player to feel a sense of accomplishment. Both the player and his targets had the ability to move back and forth, firing deadly projectiles at each other. What's more, Nishikado designed his aliens to descend toward the player with increasing speed, creating a sense of heightening tension. If the player allowed a single alien to touch down on his planet, he lost. The name that Nishikado first bestowed on his creation was Space Monsters. Later, Taito changed it to Space Invaders. In 1978, Space Invaders was initially released only in Japan. It took a while for gamers to discover it, but when they did, its popularity spread like a virus. Taito sold 100,000 Space Invaders games in Japan alone the first year. Arcades opened that offered nothing but Space Invaders. A short time later, Space Invaders reached American shores, where resistance proved futile. Taito sold 60,000 machines its first year in the United States, more than 7 times the number of Pong units Atari had sold in its first 3 years. The only reason the Space Invaders number wasn't higher was that the company held back an additional 200,000 machines it had produced to quench demand in its home country. By 1982, Space Invaders machines gobbled a collective $2 billion. For comparison, Star Wars, then the highest-grossing movie in history, had earned a mere $486 million. Space Invaders back then could lay claim to being more than just the best-selling video game ever. It was the highest-grossing entertainment vehicle ever. Space Invaders began the revolution that elevated video games from curious novelty to mainstream phenomenon. Along the way, it led arcade video games out of the darkened bars, bowling alleys, and pinball halls to which they were previously confined, and ushered them into the most public of places. Supermarkets, shopping malls, restaurants, roller rinks, convenience stores, gas stations, and, most relevant to our story, hotels and motels. My family may have been on its way to Florida or the Gulf Coast, but whenever we stopped along the way, my primary destination, like that of most other kids my age in the late 70s and early 80s, was the hotel game room. On my mission to locate and scope out the motel game room, every second was critical. Like my siblings, I was expected to report back to the lobby in timely fashion. This was because, after my dad had been handed our room keys, we'd proceed together back out to the car to collect our luggage and haul it to our room. Dad sure as hell wasn't going to get stuck doing the task himself, and he'd be damned if he was going to tip a bellhop, if one was even available, to do it for us. The consequences for a tardy return to the lobby could be serious. Depending on my mom's mood, she could deduct a dollar from my precious video game stipend, or withhold it altogether. But after hours on the road, I couldn't contain my excitement at seeing what pixelated pleasures awaited my later return. Perhaps there'd even be games I'd never seen before. Because of frequent production shortages and uneven distribution, game titles that were popular in some areas of the country were often unavailable in others. It's why hotel and motel game rooms played a vital role in spreading demand for new games. Kids would see and play them in distant places, then return home and ask about them at their local arcades. The task of finding a motel's game room wasn't always easy. Motels weren't originally built with video games in mind, and often owners didn't really know what to do with them. Video games were noisy, and so were the kids they attracted, which meant that games couldn't be placed in the lobby or near guest rooms unless the manager didn't mind dealing with constant complaints. Sometimes owners of Holiday Inns that featured holodomes would arrange the games in tidy clusters around the pool, but eventually it occurred to them that putting electronic devices in a steamy environment to be played by soaking children might not be a great idea. Usually, the solution was to locate game rooms at the distant end of some far-flung, poorly marked corridor. Even if you found an employee who could provide directions, the instructions were often impossible to follow. The weary hotel clerk or maintenance man would rattle off a long series of turns to take, staircases to ascend and descend, and landmarks to look for, until you were about as likely to locate the Holy Grail as the game room. If I did find the arcade, I'd poke my head in to take a quick inventory. By 1982, any game room